Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing the explorations of the cultures of consciousness. When I was a young man, I stumbled across the works of James Hillman. Probably some of you are familiar with the rather renegade Jungian psychotherapist who, in the early 1970s, a period of time which will come back later in our conversation today, came out with some pretty revolutionary books, at least as far as Jungian psychology was going, including the book that sort of hovers over our conversation today, The Dream and the Underworld. And there was a lot of great things about Hillman, very smart, really great writer, dense, difficult stuff, like kind of reading an alchemical text as well as a psychological book. But one of the radical ideas that that Hillman put forth is that the dark sides of the psyche, pathologies, nightmares, sexual obsessions, terrors, panic, all of these elements that we either try to control, or even if we embrace the shadow, we try to integrate it. We try to make it part of our egoic process or part of our sort of higher spiritual identity. This is a kind of idea one comes across a lot. And Hillman had a radical kind of twist on this, which is that it doesn't really ever serve a purpose. It's never actually easily integrated into the plans of the ego or even the plans of the higher spirit. Instead, it's a realm, it's a space, it's a zone of resonance, of exchange, of encounter that can never be sewn up, can never be made sense of, can never be corralled into a coherent meaning. Instead, it's something simply part of our lives, an aspect to, if not necessarily always celebrate, at least to be able to move in there the way that one can move into a nightmare and enjoy it for its nightmarishness, not necessarily for its symbolic meaning. And for me, this really set me going in a different way of dealing with the dark side of the mind, of culture, and even beginning to learn how to enjoy it more. And part of that fascination and that enjoyment and that sense of the profound and even the sacred that can be inside the darker sides of things, it was very much inspired our guest today, Andy Sharp, who's the man behind the group English Heretic, who we've had on the show before. And Andy's just released a new CD and booklet that is most entertaining and quite unusual, which is great. You know, it's tough to just put out a CD these days. But in addition to putting out a collection of excellent songs under the name The Underworld Service, he also put out a guidebook, The Underworld Service Guidebook, which is a fascinating, nicely produced sort of jaunt through psychogeography, the occult, pop culture, technological developments, the military-industrial complex. And I'm actually going to read from the Blogspot go-to page on the Underworld Service, just because he uses his language and describes what he's doing very well. The Underworld Service is a 70-minute radio broadcast from Tartarus, where every song and news report is an intimation of our mortality. The Underworld Service subverts the culture show format and celebrates the hard-hitting documentary format, scanning a wave band of corpse-oriented rock, philosophical stoner, field trip hop, horror folk, and funereal disco. The Underworld Service is English Heretic's most death-enhancing release to date. So we're going to have a good time diving into this this material, and I look forward to talking to Andy very much. But before that, bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. Morning, Maja.
Eric, I'm totally coasting right now.
You are, yeah. This is like home territory. I mean, you also have this. We talk about it regularly on the show, but a kind of fascination or a particular intimacy with some of this dark side stuff, which is, as we talked about, it's an interesting balance. You know, on the one hand, people try to pretend it's not scary and weird when it is, and then on the other hand, people kind of overdo the scary and weird, or they like fetishize the scary and weird just for being scary and weird when there's clearly a lot more going on there. So I know you've had the chance to sit with Andy's new release. I was wondering if there was any particular idea or song or whatever that struck you.
Well, I just, you know, like you mentioned, I love the entire concept of all of those things, and I'm a big investigator of subconscious or subversive or underworld types of elements. And I feel like, you know, to make an entire CD covering that with the whole thing, and you know how there's those albums that are cohesive, you know, like Pink Floyd, The Wall, or like, you know, The Cure, Disintegration. There'll be these albums that come out and the whole thing lives in an entirety. And I love those things. It's the idea of the rock opera, or like having a narrative throughout. So one of the things I really like about the Underworld Service is that it attacks it in that kind of way, to have a continual narrative and look at a theme and then kind of explore it through the whole album.
Yeah, it's a great, rather than having a kind of limited, what I hear you saying is a limited sort of concept album approach. There's a lot of concepts, there's a lot of themes, and one of the wonderful things about Andy's book that comes along with it is just how it reflects a certain, what makes thinking about these recondite, occult, sometimes conspiratorial, sometimes humorous, sometimes over the top, you know, elements, is the way in which they weave together, and you kind of move between different registers, and you kind of get this sort of dreamlike sense of associations between historical facts, actual places, mythology, cheesy exploitation movies, dreams, psychology, theory, you know, and you get this weave in this web that itself, I think, is kind of a magical invocation. So let's go ahead.
Yeah, totally.
Well, with that sense of agreement, let's bring on Andy to the show. Thanks, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the underworld. What does the underworld mean for you, man? What drew you to it? Inspired this project, and how even do you characterize it?
Yeah, well, very much James Hillman, because I probably started reading his stuff about 15 years ago. I started the English Heretic Project about 10, 11 years ago. So his kind of his methodology, really. This concept of the imaginal, that you can follow theories through using like the concept of the imaginal. So images actually tell the truth. Very much with an influence on the project itself, because of absorbing all this material and finding it, as you say, a great comfort where it wasn't trying to make complexes of things. So James Hillman's kind of like underpinned the project, although it's been about English culture in general. It's got to the stage where I realized that I was understanding some of the influences on the project better. If you've done something for 10 years, suddenly what really influenced you comes to the surface, I think.
Yeah.
So that's really one of the reasons for dedicating it to James Hillman. And obviously, he's American, So the other idea that the Underworld service was this voyage. As I say, like kind of in the liner notes, it's like I've sort of plowed this topsoil of English culture for 10 years, and I decided to go on a holiday. But where would you go? Where would English heritage go on holiday? Go on a holiday to Hades or something like that. So kind of sunset. Yeah, it's like a busman's holiday. So that was kind of the other conceit. There are other things as well.
I love that the idea of the journey, because it comes across in the sense that you feel like, you know, partly the songs have different sort of genres. Some of them are, you know, dark and foreboding. Some of them are kind of metalish. Some of them sound like electronic experiments. Some of them are more, you know, sort of almost upbeat rock tunes, folk stuff. And you kind of feel like with that and the words and the way that you mix singing and sampling, and then in the booklet, the way that you sort of talk about your own journeys, cognitive, imaginal, as well as literal, that you get this tremendous sense of a various space that you're exploring with the music and the concepts. And that's really part of the idea of the Underworld, is that it's a space, it's a place where encounters happen, where different types of environments allow us to encounter some of the things that we fear the most, some of the things that make our world so challenging and sometimes so dark. But it gives it like a location, like a landscape, and somehow that there's something about that relationship of psychological encounter or of even spiritual exploration and landscape that seems really, really key, this idea of psychogeography, which I know is so, so important to you.
Yeah. The other thing, definitely, it was locating it. But also it was this sense of indwelling in the underworld. And what I'd noticed writing fiction, particularly in the past, that my characters would die at the end, and I often thought, well, actually, that's probably a good point for the beginning of a narrative. So I'd had this feeling that a narrative should start in the underworld, and I think the reason why, there's lots of reasons, say, in a fictional narrative, why the characters die. It's partly what I think I mentioned in the book, is that you've got this creative vision, and then if you think about Robert Graves' sort of argument, you'll have a challenge to that. So it'll be the weird, or the critic, or your inner voice will come and go, oh, this isn't making sense, and you'll kill off the narrative. And I thought that was a very interesting point to start it. So you've got this sense of like blackening, you're in the dark, and to actually, what would it like to be living in that space? Can we actually see colour in it? Can we actually begin to see subtle light in it? So I kind of give it a lot of the colour schemes are like verdigris, because if you go to a cemetery, you'll often see like kind of verdigris on the statues and things like that. And I like this idea that suddenly there'd be this kind of subtle colour in that space, and then you could gradually make form of it and things like that. Because as you say, people's idea of the underworld is blackening and dark. Mm. But the point was to actually see in the dark rather than have this kind of sort of manic reaction to descent.
Well, and what do you think about if you can talk about that a little bit, how it does have that affiliation with like blackness and evil and darkness, like in your traverses? I mean, a lot of the themes of the album are raising those things to conscious awareness and then kind of like removing the evilness from them. Do you think that there is, do you think it's just like a reaction to those things that causes us to put that in the dark black places, those descriptions, or is it, you know, why do people automatically have those things when we're talking about the world?
Yeah, I think, well, as you say, you know, it's, I think there's this desire for, it goes back to Hillman, this desire for perfection. You know, we've got this desire for, if you think about the Kabbalah, you've got like Kisa, white light, and this desire for ascent, and that was very much what Hillman's reacting against, and saying that is actually part of the problem, is like, you know, this messianic ascent myth that we have in our in kind of Western monolithic religion. And so my argument is that, and again, it's following Hillman, is that it's actually a less pathological thing, really, to perceive the world as not perfect than it is perfect.
Absolutely. I think that's key. It's funny all these things are resonating. I was just reading a account of Osho, of Rajneesh's early life, and he was describing his own after his own whatever so-called enlightenment experience that he had in his 20s, which didn't sound very pleasant, by the way. He has this line about it's not about reaching the top of the ladder. It's about throwing away the ladder and not needing one anymore. And there is something about this archetype of verticality, an archetype of transcendence that's so deep in Western civilization. I want to riff on it a little bit and hear what you guys have to say, because it's reminding me right now of the author Morris Berman, and he has an idea where he links that notion of verticality and ascendance in a spiritual sense with the emergence of the state. You know, as soon as you have a political state where you have hierarchies and social roles, and there's an elite and then there's the rabble, then we get these pyramids, these structures, these ladders, these stairways to heaven. And then I think part of what's happening, and what Hillman initiates us to in a lot of ways, I think the counterculture opened this up, psychedelics opened this up, horror films opened this up, a lot of the things that are weaving into your work, what they do is to kind of try to dismantle that and to say, like, whether or not it's good that we're still sort of living in this state, that's a whole other question, but is that there's something in us, and there's something more ancient in us that is not about hierarchies, ladders, verticality, but is instead about depth and descent. But it's not a depth and descent into the mire, into the mere matter, into hell. It's something weirder, and that requires it has its own kind of light, its own kind of evolutionary impulse. And I'm curious, just for you, like, when you think about the idea of going within as a practice, as a way of consuming culture, what sort of guides you? What, like, as you sort of go through your options, your creative possibilities, the places to go, what is it that lets you sort of sense when something is a good portal towards that deeper descent, in a way?
Well, I think the thing is that it's about trusting the narrative that is overriding kind of your life at any particular stage. And I realized sort of two or three years ago that I was essentially, a lot of my interests were like descent narratives that I could see in a different way. And I could view them in a lot of different ways. So it was pretty much trusting the way I felt, and therefore actually a lot of the trips I did, I wasn't aware until I started coalescing them and putting them into a kind of time span, which is over about 2.5 years. Actually, these are all descent narratives, and I use the term catabasis, which means a journey to the underworld, but it also means a journey towards the sea. And so the sea is a good example of the unconscious. So I began to see, I visited this place. I traveled to the shore here, and I began to see, again, it's just trusting. A lot of this comes from Hillman, really, you know, the fact that if you work with the imaginal, then you begin to see images doubling in the landscape and in your mind, or in your mind's eye, and things like that. So it's really a trust of the image that come to you. So it is a meditative process that I think has very much come from James Hillman, but also to a certain degree from another book that I mentioned in there, Fulcanelli's Mystery Cathedrals, which was a way of which I see as a way of kind of looking at the landscape as a set of alchemical ciphers. So you begin to see, I mean, that's full of double entendres, mystery cathedrals. So I'm very much working with the concept of the double, where I'll see one image relating to another, and that's how the narrative has kind of developed, really. So it's seeing things within our eye, really.
It's so good. A lot of that is, it's like that concept of reflection, and has to do with seeing, and like literally with your physical eyeballs, where stuff is reflected back and then taken through, and you see the thing twice, or it has two sides. I mean, do you think part of like that hierarchy we're talking about, like even if it's not like authority stuff or metaphysical or even conceptual, do you think part of it is also just like the physical structure of your brain? Like how, you know, the underworld could literally be like, if it's your subconscious, is that just the bottom part of your brain? And then the side thing is like, it's all focused at the top. Is that the ladder, or is it like, is it more complicated?
Well, you can think of it like that, certainly the brain, because the way it develops from, you know, it develops outwards, doesn't it? So your cognitive centers are at the top of the head, aren't they? And your animal centers are at the bottom. And the way the brain's evolved is in this kind of folding layer of cognition. But, you know, to a certain degree, you know, cognitions become this thing that's kind of crippled us in a way, you know.
Right.
Certainly the cognitive centers have created this great intellectual ability and ability to work with highly kind of cybernetic systems, if you think. But I think at the root of that, you know, there's obviously, kind of the bedrock of emotions and things like that. So the brain is, it is definitely a hierarchical structure. But I don't know where to locate the unconscious really within that.
Right, it's kind of just everywhere.
Yeah, it's a good point. It is everywhere, you know, and that's kind of what I was saying in the narrative for the Underworld Service, is that no matter what radio stations you tune into, you'll hear a song about it has intimation of your mortality.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of, yeah. But I think this is, it's interesting. It's a certain meditative state that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a certain quietude, you know, there's a certain calmness that you, an acceptance there. That you can deal with this, you know. I don't think it's a particularly evil album or dark album, and that was part of the concept, is that I didn't want to do something, a project that was intrinsically frightening. Though having said that, you know, it's got recordings from Hiroshima, which, you know, it must be my own perverse nature that I don't think that's you know, horrific or,
it really happened. That's the thing. Like, whether you think it's horrific or not, it was a real event. So
yeah, definitely. And I think part of the interest in doing that is somehow we've forgotten that it happened.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the really frightening thing is that we've somehow forgotten that we've created this technology.
Well, but that goes back to the looking thing, right? And with the location of the unconscious, it is. It's like people don't want to look at the terrible things. They don't want to think about Hiroshima. Why would they want to do that? But it, in fact, really occurred. So it is this kind of like selective viewing kind of situation.
Well, it also reminds us of why, how helpful some of this occult or fictional or dreamlike thinking can be, because it can remind us of the things that have actually happened. So, if you know, we all know that Hiroshima happened. Yeah, it was the end of the war, blah, blah, blah. Some people think it was a good idea. We saved lives or not. And it becomes just part of this sort of ordinary story of like, well, it's just history. It's full of tragedy. And we just keep moving on. And there's something about the specificity of it, the event of it, the particular, peculiar horror and also sort of the symbolic weight of it, we just kind of forget. Whereas in the dream world, in the unconscious world, in the occult world, in the horror, then we start to remember, or we get a sense of these deeper meanings that we almost usually want to avoid. I mean, one of the things you talk about in your booklet is that notion that Kenneth Grant came up with in the early 70s in one of his marvelously florid occult tomes, that, you know, with Hiroshima, there's kind of an event that changes the Earth's status on a cosmic scale, and suddenly all of these extraterrestrial intelligences sort of wake up and recognize that we're, like, something's happening on Earth, and that this initiates the modern UFO revival. It draws different kinds of intelligences to circle the planet, et cetera, et cetera. And you get into the zone of whatever you want to call it, the occult thinking, conspiracy thinking, you know, dream work, historical fabulation. And yet those fictions or stories or evocations or imaginal events, they actually in some ways point to the truth of an event like Hiroshima more than conventional histories do, which always try to normalize it, like, oh yes, it was terrible, but, you know, we moved on and Japan emerged as a world power, blah blah blah.
Yeah, yeah.
And we lose the intimacy with the way that the unconscious is in our history, it's in our reality, it's in our culture, it's not just in our minds that we dip into occasionally at night.
Yeah, definitely, and also, you know, the value of, like, things like Kenneth Grant it offers, like, an extreme metaphor or an extreme vision of it, which I think it needs. You can't, as you say, you can't downplay those things, and the more we try and normalize them, I think, you know, the more that we're, have the potential of that happening again, but what I found interesting, I'd obviously was very aware of Grant and Bertio's work, but coming to the project, I was slightly less aware of works like Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano.
Talk a little bit about that book, just because it's a great book that not enough people read. So tell me about how you encountered it, or what was it in that book that fed into your project?
How did I come across it? I came across it through just various quotes, and actually the language I thought was incredibly beautiful. I thought this is with all fiction, I think you could, a good writer can write about anything, and I thought the particularly what interested me was his actual use of words. A very, very lyrical use of words, and then obviously reading it and realizing that he was actually, you know, playing with a Kabbalistic system, I thought was very interesting. You know, everything was revolved around sort of the last day and 12 hours and things like that, and the number 12. So I thought it worked on lots of different levels, and I started thinking about lyricism and alcohol, really, and that he was kind of using alcohol like a like the psychedelicists did in the 60s, in a way. You know, he knew that he was destroying himself, but his book is very drunk, you know. So it's got this, it's kind of like a, it's a psychedelic book about alcohol, and I found that very interesting.
No, you totally nailed it. That's exactly the way that you read these prose passages, and he's like going off, and, you know, it's a story of this semi-autobiographical story of an alcoholic guy who's spending his last day in Mexico, and he goes on these lyrical flights, and it's sort of like Joyce or something, and then, but it's got this alcoholic craziness. But then beyond that, there's this kind of mystical element that comes in that's really quite extraordinary, psychedelic alcoholic lyricism. But it's such a descent. You know, it's such a descent.
But the other interesting thing is, obviously, yeah, it's a katabatic fiction. So it's again, you know, as I was saying to you earlier, I was saying, you know, writing fiction myself, I was thinking, why in my mind does a vision go off the page? You know, I think that's when you end a story, usually a bit of fiction, because you lose the vision. And I thought it was very interesting, you know, Lowry is in that state, you know, he started off in that state. So that was an important, you know, link for the book. It actually kind of fitted some sort of psychological model that I was fitting myself in terms of how what fiction could be, you could say. But there's something else I was going to say. Yeah, and I also thought it was interesting, you know, one of the things I speculate on is I look at the links between Lowry and Fulcanelli and the Situationists. Fulcanelli wrote, who's an alchemist in the early 20th century in Paris. Nobody really knows his identity, but one of the people they think was Fulcanelli was this guy called Jean-Julien Champagne, who is Fulcanelli's illustrator, but was also, you know, a chronic absence abuser. And I've often speculated that Mystery Cathedrals, because it talks about the green language, the langue verte, my feeling is that that might have come out of Jean-Julien Champagne and his absinthe use. So that was a nice link between. So look at you know the parallels and the possibilities that. Yeah. There is this
and, color that, and that very color reminds me earlier of our discussion where you're talking about the color of the underworld, where it's not just a dark place, but there's this sort of milky green to it, the quality of moss on a tombstone. There's a certain kind of sort of burnished green that is quite evocative.
Definitely, yeah, that's exactly, yeah. You got it in absinthe, you got it in this green language, yeah. And and as you say, you got it in the kind of sort of flora in a cemetery as well. So, yeah, definitely. But the other interesting link I thought between, that I found very interesting between Lowry and the kind of work I do is that the Situationists, I didn't, again, like just in the course of researching the project, you know, came across an interview with I can't remember, Debord or Van Aan, and they'd paid homage to Malcolm Lowry by doing these kind of negative epiphanies to this place called Sarcelles, just outside Paris, which was kind of like an urban sort of utopia that quickly became a kind of ghetto, really. But they were kind of like seeing this place, Sarcelles, as like the nadir of modernism, really. So they underwent these kind of negative pilgrimages, which you can almost think of as like kind of black masses or witchcraft, really, where everything's reversed. So they would do, you know, they were trying to actually destroy this kind of concept or fight against it. But when they went there, they were like high on mescaline. and they did that as a homage to Lowry. So I thought it was very interesting, this idea of a negative pilgrimages, and again with like Hillman, negative epiphanies. You know, this idea that you can do something religious. But it doesn't have to be ecstatic.
Yeah, no, I mean, what that brings to mind is the sort of practice, particularly, which we have plenty of opportunity to do today, of recognizing and interfacing, engaging, encountering the tremendous ugliness of our landscape, you know, through capital development, through strip malls, through mining, you know, through munitions fields, abandoned madhouses, army bases. There's so much ugly, weird, unpleasant landscape that surrounds us. And in some sense, if we just seek to only have enchanted relationships with the charming and the sublime aspects of our landscape, we're missing out on a whole side of psychogeographical experience. But some of, but in order to do that, you have to be able to kind of go on a negative pilgrimage. Like, it's, you're not going to get the juicy, you know, romantic sunset at you know, during the encounter. You're going to see the, you know, the world that we've built and the shadow side, the underside of modernity, of technology, or whatever. But there is a sacred, or there can be, I think, a sacred dimension or a kind of encounter that happens in those places too, if we tune the imaginal to work on more weird spectra than we might normally do.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing is, you know, this comes back to Ruskin's idea of illth and wealth, and I think Robert Anton Wilson talks about it when he was saying, you know, kind of definition of illth is like where a great amount of money has been invested in destruction, you know. So if you think about like a military base, which I talk about a couple that I went to, one in Suffolk, where they tested the detonators for the British atomic bomb, and it's an incredible landscape. But it isn't actually, you know, it's the illth that comes from it is the amount of investment in, like, human lives, you know, people's working lives. They were spending in these laboratories and all the money invested on destruction. And this is kind of the concept of illth, that there is this kind of, again, like, you know, negative wealth, really. But the places themselves, you know, if you look at them with your eye, without looking at it from a political or a moral point of view, you know, it's an incredible place. This ruined landscape called Orford Ness. It's got these huge, like, concrete pagodas that look like they're like animist temples or something like that, and like some of the sort of blast walls and stuff like that look like I don't know, like burial mounds and things like that. So one of the things I'm interested in doing is to try and look at these places, you know, stripping out the illth in a way. What do these really look like? What would they look like if we didn't know what they were there for? So this concept of like a future archaeology where you go to a place and we've lost all our knowledge due to whatever, like an atomic bomb or something like that, a nuclear war. What would these places actually look like? How would we misconstrue them and stuff like that?
That seems to be a very important part of the sort of shadow work of the underworld is precisely that recognition of the spirit of that lies on the other side of the ugly or the horror, but then kind of working with that, because you don't want to overly aestheticize and say, oh, it's so beautiful, the signs of destruction and war and violence. And yet there is a kind of beauty there, but it's a somber beauty or a spectral beauty that I think is part of the aesthetics of the underworld, which is part of the experience. But anyway, we need to take a break here. We're going over a little bit. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Andy Sharp about the underworld, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dao here with Erica Davis, and we're speaking with Andy Sharp about the underworld. So before the break, you were talking about some things that were really important, I think. And let's talk a little bit about what is that relationship between the utopia and the underworld? They seem to transpose like an awful lot. Like, you can go so far into the underworld that you pop out into heaven, right? So there seems to be, there's some kind of like secret portal that goes from the most terrible thing to the most wonderful thing. And that, of course, is alchemy, right? Is that when you come into the center of polarization and it's all the same thing. So have you experienced, or can you talk a little bit about what is that connection, or like even like people who, like you said, go in the messianic route and get destructive in their attempts to build utopias, then they end up at the underworld. So it's like you can seek heaven and get to hell, and you can seek through hell and get to heaven. What do you think is the relationship between the two?
Well, the relationship? Well, I think often, like, if you go deep enough into hell, these like kind of like psychic sort of reflexes will happen. Like, if you think of something like gallows humor, you know, the concept of gallows humor, which is, you know, you're at a funeral and you want to crack a joke, you know, and I think it is a kind of like some kind of like euphoric mechanism kicks in the brain, and that's I think that's a survival thing. I've experienced bereavement, young people, young friends, peers who've died very suddenly. And what I noticed in those situations, I remember when I was at college, a guy died very suddenly in a horrible way, fell down a lift, you know. And what I noticed in all the peers, and all suddenly there was this sense of euphoria, weirdly enough, in the whole group of people on our course, and everybody started, you know, kind of sleeping around and things like that. And they've been quite conservative up then. And that's when I sort of noticed, and I've subsequently seen this a couple of other times in life, is that when a shock death happens within a group of people, then there is this sudden euphoria, which is, I think, is a kind of chemical thing to stop you, you know, going under. It's like a sedative or something like that. So I think that's what, when you go in a psychic journey, or, you know, what I can call it, a psychic journey, is that happens in your brain anyway. You know, some completely pathetic sort of response will happen, I notice I'll be writing something and thinking something, trying to write a bit of music that's very, very dark and stuff like that, and some ludicrous idea will come into the mind. And I think that's a survival mechanism. And I think the tendency is, if you're doing a bit of writing or a bit of music, is to ignore that ludicrous sort of thing that happens deep in the, or that kind of like salvational bit of euphoria that happens in the dark space. But I kind of wanted to play with that. I haven't consciously tried to, but I haven't edited it out when it's come in the narrative.
Well, because there's a significant creational energy there. I mean, a lot of people, like, think of how many beautiful creations have been made in those places of death and grief. That's like every amazing rock album comes from the breakup, right? Not from the good times. So there is that creation energy that lies in destruction that then kind of gets rebirthed through individuals that I think pay attention to those moments you're talking about, those euphoric moments in those places.
Definitely. Or you've got the kind of, you know, it's a fine line of whether you can run with it and whether you can hold that state with it, isn't it, and work with it without sort of quitting out or going, you know, just trying to frighten people or trying to be horrific, so it's, yeah, definitely, absolutely, you know, an album that I quote quite a bit and reference in a way is Closer by Joy Division, you know, because I think that was, an album that was obviously, you know, written as Ian Curtis was, you know, on the point of committing suicide. But actually, when you listen to it, it's very uplifting in places. And I think that's a very good example, really, of a good bit of rock music that has a very, you know, sad story around it, but isn't actually like, it's actually pretty uplifting music in a weird way.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of music, I want to make sure that we get a little sample of the Underground Service in here today, because we're approaching the end, and I want to the track I chose is the The Alchemist of Saltine. We'll just hear the first minute or so, because one of the things I really like about the record is the way that you have some really long samples. Some of them are from recordings you made, some of them from horror movies and other things. But it doesn't feel like a sampledelic record. It feels like the movement between the samples and the singing and the music is all kind of interwoven in a really interesting way that kind of brings it forward, both as a documentary artifact and as kind of a sort of aesthetic move. And I thought the beginning of this track really worked. So let's hear the beginning of The Alchemist of Saltine.
The beast that's closest to where we are now is my house. Is Saltine Beach, which, as you've seen, is literally just down the road. And basically, there's two ways of getting to the beach. So you can walk over the cliffs and go down the steps to the beach, or from the village of Saltine, there's a tunnel, an underpass, which takes you from the village under the cliffs out onto the beach. So that is very much like a kind of portal to the haunted shoreline, and it really has that feel to it as well when you're walking down that tunnel. And also the fact that you're walking under the cliffs, under the chalk rock, which is the main rock type in the cliffs around here. It's like you're actually going into the very substance of the shoreline by doing that, and then you come out on the other side, you know, almost like a sci-fi movie where they go through a wormhole.
So I assume the Alchemist is a character, is someone you know, or is that a citation? Did you write that material? What is the
no,
that encounter?
No, it is actually somebody got in touch. A guy, it goes by the pseudonym of Haunted Shoreline, is actually a scientist, and he got in touch a couple of years ago, and had started this blog that was documenting his visits to. Nearby beach and sort of doing this occult beach combing. So I've put him on a couple of times on a couple of talks and we sort of saw a similarity in some of the concepts. He's not one of my made up characters.
Yeah, no, I didn't think so. But I what I really loved about that track was the sense of how much came through to me, just of the sense not only of that particular landscape with the description of the chalk or the sense of a tunnel under a village or whatever, but it just immediately reminded me of all these spaces that I encountered, particularly when I was younger, where you'd stumble into a culvert or there's some weird way between two houses, and the way that in the midst of our ordinary landscape. I mean, this is that psychogeographical gesture, is that in the midst of our ordinary landscape, there are these portals and they take you places. And sometimes in the right frame of mind, just going up a different street or looking through someone's backyard or looking, you know, being in a cemetery, there's a sense of moving into a kind of different space. And, you know, I know you've done a lot of that. I'm curious whether right now are there particular landscapes or places that are really inspiring you or that have sort of revealed their secrets to you in your area or other places?
Again, it goes back to Hillman. Hillman had this idea. He had this concept or this aphorism that said, psyche picks her geographies, and I think that's absolutely brilliant, you know, that actually our psyche is dictating where we want to go and things like that, and she's reeling in kind of animated symbols and things like that. So a place I've really the last couple of years I've been visiting a lot is Peak District in Derbyshire, which I do talk about, but I probably will be visiting there a lot more in the next year. And my kind of like cultural reference points I had for it was this zombie horror film was sort of incongruously made in this utterly beautiful limestone ravine in Derbyshire in the 70s, and it's totally acted like a portal for lots of different things, enabling me to sort of map some of the cultural interests in the 70s, some of the political sort of ructions in that area in the 80s, and some folklore that's kind of doubled the film. So I found it a very kind of very inspiring place.
Yeah, it's a wonderful layering, and we only have a few minutes left, and I feel kind of remiss because I've been doing a lot of work on the early 70s and really coming to appreciate on a deeper and deeper level how instrumental and fascinating and over the top, but also influential that sort of period was, and that we don't really, unlike the 60s and unlike the sort of superficial ideas of the 70s with disco and cocaine and hedonism or whatever, that there's something that we sort of don't quite understand. And there's something enigmatic and uncanny about particularly the early to mid 70s that you talk about it quite well and very interestingly in your book there. And I just wanted to hear you reflect a little about that period and how it's something that you keep coming back to and that informs your work. I'm just really curious.
Well, again, as I see it, it was kind of this idea that catabasis and then its reaction, the anabasis. So you had after the war and Hiroshima created this kind of descent narrative, and then sort of 60s Kennedy was assassinated, and again, as I was saying to Martha, there was this kind of euphoric reaction to it. So, you know, this kind of, I think, you know, in a way it birthed the 60s, but then again, if you look at Hillman, there was a, you know, this kind of spiritual inflation, he calls it. So the spiritual inflation created things like Manson and guru pathologies. And I think that the early 70s is very interesting because it marks the beginning of a descent where we start to understand and start to embrace the underworld in a more sober way, really, in something that we can't escape. And I don't think we've really, you know, I don't necessarily see that as a negative thing. I see that as a kind of quite sober thing. So, and the way I look at it is that you saw it in the work of like Grant and Bertio, you know, the first edition of the Necronomicon in 73. We had all this obsession with the Egyptian underworld in Britain in the mid early 70s. And I also bring in Polanski's apartment trilogy films because I think they're very, very interesting because you've got kind of Repulsion, which is about a hinting at the psychosis in swinging London. Then you've got the full-blown satanic denouement of Rosemary's Baby. Then you've got his third film in the early 70s, which is called The Tenant, which features lots of underworld imagery. You know, it's got scenes that are set in the toilet where he's hallucinating kind of hieroglyphs from a tomb. And I think the 70s are very interesting for those sort of narratives that they brought in, you know, zombie films and things like that, that we were beginning to embrace the underworld in a way.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of my riffs on the whole 70s period is that the conventional, you know, if you ask people or you look around online, whatever, and like when people try to sort of capture the spirit of this very weird era, you know, they'll remember, oh, you know, smiley faces and tacky clothes and, you know, really ridiculously long mutton chops and disco pants and all this kind of silly, superficial, tacky stuff, which was certainly part of the era. But I think in a lot of ways, all of that stuff is just a screen that enables people to not really look at what was substantial about the era, which was precisely the things you're talking about, that there was an engagement with the dark, with the underground, with psychosis, with a recognition of what follows the kind of explosion of the 60s, like the things that, you know, you still have to deal with. You're not getting out of pathology. The pathology is part of who we are. It's never going to go away. And culture itself, society itself, can go pathological. Like in the States, Watergate is like this pathological nightmare. It's like a dream. Like it's like the king, the president, is doing all this completely nasty stuff. He's this total monster.
Yeah,
and,
it's very true.
And
you got
to
yeah.
peel back the layers to find it. And so I think there's something very rich there that I particularly in our era right now, where we're dealing with paranoia and surveillance and the war machine and ecology and energy issues. In a lot of ways, we're kind of like doubling over, I think, this era that we still haven't really come to terms with in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think in a way, you know, I, as I say, I don't think it is necessarily a negative thing. I think it's a kind of like a maturation of the psyche that we realize that actually, you know, the idealism of the 60s was, as I said, like a heroic attempt to climb out of a Hades of our own making, you know. But the problem, what we've got to deal with is this, like, kind of the Hades of our own making. How do we actually deal with the fact that we've got, you know, we built these machines that can destroy us and things like that? You know, let's, you know, how do we actually deal with it? In it? How does the psyche deal with it in a way as well? I guess I'm saying I'm not necessarily looking for political solutions, but I'm saying how does the psyche deal with it, you know?
Absolutely, and just that fine line, you know, I mean, I want to totally support you on the notion that when we talk about the dark or the pathological or whatever, from that imaginal point of view, from that Hillman point of view, that's not a negative. It's part of what's going on, and there's an opportunity for, like you say, a kind of sobriety, a kind of acceptance of the condition that we're actually in, the failure of the heroic attempt to climb out of it. And the last thing we need right now in society is like another repetition of some technological solution, some ladder to the heavens that's going to let us pull ourselves out of this condition as the kind of nightmare or as the Hades becomes more and more evident in our world. We have to look at it. We have to sort of find the light in the cracks in it, the strange greenish overtones.
Yeah, and the other thing is the poetry. You know, what is the poetry of this kind of world? You know, and as I see, what poetry is kind of meaningful, meaningful connections. You know, where meaningful codes and symbols and things like that. So you know, I hope you know there's a certain poetry to the way that the project tells the story, rather than it be this happened, this happened, this happened, or I try and like create a poetry of it, really, you know. So you've got these associations and connections without having like kind of a moral ladder out of it or whatever.
Exactly. Well, I think you've done a very fine job. So we have to wrap it up here. Just want to let people know you can go to englishheretic.blogspot.co.uk and get your hands on the Underworld Service CD. It's very worth the whole package because the book is half of the picture. And so, Andy, thanks so much for joining us again. This was a great conversation.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks, Martha, too. Yeah, great to talk to you again.
All right, excellent. Well, good luck with the stuff. And from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.